This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This is part two of our comedy and mental health mini-series, and this week we're talking to comedian Zoe Lyons. I've been a fan of her for some time and saw her perform for the first time live last year at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and she is revisiting with that same show. So I can confirm, having seen it twice now, that it is very good. But I'm delighted to have got the chance to interview her all about how comedy has affected her mental health. In the episode, we talk a lot about the loneliness that can come with travelling on her own, as many comedians and other types of performers do. There's also a particularly poignant moment as well where she describes times when her mental health has been really at its worst, and yet she's been away from home and needed to go out and perform for a room of strangers and make them laugh. And that kind of contrast is something that I'm aware of a lot in comedy, that the comedian has to separate to some degree what's happening behind the scenes for them personally to go out there and do their job of making other people happy, even when they're struggling to make themselves happy. And it is a poignant thing that's part of the industry, and it's part of why I'm glad to be covering this theme.
Yeah, because it's something that I've not really thought about before, is the fact that they do travel, but they travel on their own, on their road. And so you are left with your own thoughts and thinking about your show, and then after the show, if it went well, if it didn't, like, you know, where's that initial support system that's, you know, actors will get when they go on set? You've got everyone around you. But with comedians, I guess it can be quite isolating.
Yeah, absolutely. That did come across in Zoe's episode. The good news is we do also talk about how she was able to tackle that and learn from those experiences. She mentions getting to a certain point in her career that she couldn't go on feeling the way she's feeling. And actually, since she's started making changes in her life, it's just really transformed how she feels, but also how she interacts with her work, with her job.
That's really interesting. That's, you know, really interesting to listen to.
And if there's one thing I really hope comes of more comedians being open about their mental health on stage, not just will that reduce the stigma, but hopefully it will create less of that separation. So if they are having a bad time and they feel more empowered to acknowledge it to the audience, then I think it creates a kind of authenticity that lends itself to working on your mental health.
Yeah.
If your mental health struggles are more public, maybe it'll be harder to kind of hide from them and create this kind of separation. Like, I'm just going to shovel this down for my work. And instead, no, your working, your journey with mental health can go together.
Yeah, absolutely. What an amazing way to look at it. You can think, oh, well, you know, my mental health's struggling and I'm doing this job. But actually, like you said, one can really support the other if you look at it like that.
That's how I'm hoping. That's my little optimist brain is going for that as the win.
It'll all be okay. It's great. It'll all help each other. It'll be fine. We know that. But no, but it's still an absolutely valid point.
And we've got to stay optimistic when we're working to reduce stigma, because we're working to reduce something that is so prevalent. And so we've got to believe that it's going to change, because in part it already is changing. And I'm so glad to be a part of that. And so, yes, I'm delighted we've got another great conversation that's open and honest about mental health, so that hopefully people that hear it feel a bit more empowered. I know that Zoe found she got a lot out of speaking more about this as well, as many of our guests do. So I think it's a really brilliant interview. I'm delighted to have Zoe as part of our comedy and mental health mini-series. So this is part two, and we've got one more episode coming out the following Thursday. Also, you may have noticed a little bonus episode in your feed. In that, I asked a few of the comedians I interviewed one important question relating to comedy and mental health. So do check that out if you haven't already given it a listen. Was there anything else you wanted to mention, Danielle?
No, but great. I mean, I'm jealous that you've seen her twice and I haven't seen her once yet. Like, I'm so jealous because I know that she's amazing and the reviews and the feedback that she gets is amazing. So, yes, I am jealous. So I'm going to be sure to book in to see her at the next available opportunity. But well done. Exciting episode. It's going to be really cool.
Definitely. And she did say when she's next in Birmingham, she's going to let me know. So hopefully we can go be in the front row.
Yeah.
That'd be good fun. So yeah, I'm really delighted with how the episodes turned out. We'll get into that in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Zoe Lyons, and my first experiences with mental health, I guess, were probably around about the age of 10 or 11 when my parents divorced, and it was quite a stressful time. And we had to move from Surrey, where we'd been living, to Glasgow, which was quite a stressful time. And I think that's when I first became aware of sort of personally being depressed and anxious. And it manifested itself in alopecia. So I lost, I'd say, about a third of my hair when I was about 11 years old due to the sort of stress of the family situation that we were going through. And, yeah, I guess that's when I was first... That's when the sort of bubble burst, shall we say. We were like, oh, there's this part of life as well, is there? Okay, right. And I carried that with me for quite a while through school in Glasgow. I would say I was reasonably unhappy most of the time. That's how I would, looking back on it now, I'd say that was depression. Because of the family situation. B, I was an outsider within we'd moved. I had a comb over, which is never a good look on a 12-year-old girl. And then the beginnings of realising that I was gay. So that sort of added on to it. So yeah, I would say pretty miserable teenage years. I didn't really seek help for it. My mother made me go to a psychiatrist when I was about 16, but I found her incredibly irritating and didn't go back. I always remember she said to me, "Have you ever thought about killing yourself?" And I just turned to her and went, "You're telling me there are people that haven't?" And I thought, "You're an amateur, we're not doing this anymore." And I never went back.
It sounds almost like they didn't know what to do with you.
No, they didn't really know what to do with me at all. My mother was so desperate. My mum came into the office with me with the psychologist, and she burst into tears and just went, "I don't know what to do with this." And I was a 16-year-old girl as well. You've got hormones, you've got all those things happening. Yeah, I don't think there was anything the psychologist could have helped me to do at that point, because actually I just really desperately wanted to be free and independent and have a better life. And no psychologist was ever going to be able to help me to do that, or deal with my sexuality, or make my hair grow back, or any of those things, or make me feel less of an outsider. So, yeah, I just sort of got on with it. And then went to university, where I felt a bit happier, but then I suffered from awful, crippling panic attacks when I got to about the age of 19. Absolutely brutal, probably induced by smoking a bit too much weed and having a bit too much booze, with having a slightly fragile mind as well at that stage in life. And I got myself in a right mess with, horrifically crippling panic attacks. They were so physical. That was the shocking thing about them. If you've ever had a panic attack, you know, it's very different to anxiety. It's brutal, it's extreme, it's immediate. And it used to manifest itself in my jaw would lock. Like, it was really physical. It was to the point where I thought there was something physically wrong with me. Like, I'd get these tingling sensations all over my head, my jaw would lock, and I wouldn't be able to speak. And then just that awful sensation, you're going to die horribly any minute soon. I probably had those for about a year, to the point where I was struggling to leave my bedroom. I could feel that happening, that the onset of agoraphobia was creeping in at the edges. And I went to the doctor, and they did that classic thing, and just gave me, I would say, I think the medical term is, a shit ton of tablets. Just boxes and boxes of tablets of antidepressants, I guess they were. And I took them for a little while, and then I binned them all. I just threw them all out. I just thought, I don't want this to be my life. And I threw them all out.
And did you find they made a difference to you before that?
I think they took the edge off. But I remember just one day looking at them and just going, no, not having that. The problem I had, I think, with the panic attacks is I didn't tell anybody for a long time because I thought if I told somebody, it would actually make it real. Because up until that point, it's just something you're carrying around in your own head. As soon as you say it, it's become an organic monster. It's become a real thing. It's an actual thing. And obviously, as I've learned since then, you know, the best thing to do is to get it out into the open and get it, you know, release it into the oxygen so that you can at least talk about it and confront it. But yeah, I just knew very early on I didn't want a life on tablets. I hate taking tablets. Mm. Even now, if I've got a headache, I refuse to take a Nurofen. I'm like really bad at taking tablets.
I'm not great with them. I still have Calpol.
That's quite extreme.
You can imagine. As an adult, that's like a whole bottle a day to fight off a cold.
I'm really bad. I mean, I talk about my shoulder tablets I have to take because of my period pain that I suffer. They're the only tablets I take religiously, and I have to take them. But other than that, I'm really bad at taking tablets. I don't like the idea of being manipulated. Do you know what I mean? Or altered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's it. And we don't really know what they're doing, and particularly when it comes to drugs relating to mental health.
Yeah.
A lot of it is still guesswork.
And I appreciate, and of course I acknowledge that people have to take tablets in order to get on with their lives, you know, certain mental health issues. Absolutely, I get it, you know.
Yeah, but it absolutely can make such a difference. Totally. But at the same time, everyone reacts slightly differently.
Yeah.
So you can have the most qualified psychiatrist in the country. They're still going to be trying things out on you.
Yeah.
And so I think as a patient, that can be a bit scary to think
about. Yeah. I think I'm very lucky in that I was, you know, able to go the other way, to not have to be reliant on them, because I'd really hate that.
And so up to that point, you hadn't been talking about the panic attacks. Were the people around you aware of anything that was going on mental health-wise for you?
Yes. I mean, eventually I had to talk about the panic attacks because I had to phone my mum to come and get me from the centre of Glasgow one day, because I'd driven in with some friends and then it had just hit me out of the blue, and she had to come and get me, and I couldn't drive or anything. And then that's when we became aware that this was the situation. Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether we talked much about mental health itself. Do you know what I mean? Of why I was in this situation, of what would make it better. I can't remember really discussing it that deeply with my parents. Probably because I knew it also. Half the course was smoking a bit too much weed at university, and that sort of tipped me over the edge. Mm. That was probably what had happened.
But I think that happens with a lot of people's parents. Yeah. You kind of talk around the issues.
You
sort of use like supplementary words about like being a bit of a worrier and not actually acknowledging what's really going on.
I was a terrible worrier when I was younger as well. Really. I used to worry an awful lot. Looking back, I can see what it was that, like, if anything went wrong in the house that we lived in, it would really freak me out. I remember once there was a leak in one of the rooms, and the ceiling bubbled, and my level of anxiety about it was completely disproportionate to what was happening. It's a leak in the house, it was just a bit of guttering. But looking back, you kind of go, oh, it's sort of the destruction of something, it's a destruction of a home or whatever, you know. You go, oh, that's what that probably was. It really, really used to bother me, yeah.
But that's it. When you're that young, you don't know.
No.
You know, you could be there waiting for the whole house to fall down any moment.
Yeah.
And you don't know that's not what everyone else is going through.
Yeah. I still to this day have recurring dreams about waking up and water just pouring down walls. I'll have that dream maybe once a month. Yeah. Just walls falling down and water falling down. I have very, very vivid dreams. That my wife can't believe the things I'd say to her in the morning when I wake up. In fact, I had one here the other night that was so awful. You wake up in such a state. They're just so visual and so often really horribly violent. And I'm really surprised when other people don't have these dreams. Like, my wife hardly dreams. Like, she'll wake up and go, oh, I dreamt about a tomato last night. I can't believe that I hardly ever dreamt. I'm like, tomato? I dreamt about a skinned, crucified kangaroo that was being attacked by aliens. And she's like, Jesus Christ.
And so you mentioned about medication.
Yeah.
And you said you were very glad to have been able to go down another route.
Yeah.
So what did you find better suited you?
I mean, when I was at university, I'm 47 now, so what, we're going back 20 plus years. I can't remember mental health being mentioned in any way, shape or form at university at all. I remember having a panic attack at university and having to call for help for a doctor or something, and the nurse came out, and she couldn't have been less sympathetic if she tried. She absolutely couldn't have given less of a shit. It was, I mean, it was clearly in distress, but she, I mean, obviously just thought I was, you know, what time wasting, I think, was probably the thing that was going through her head. It just wasn't spoken about, wasn't talked about. There was, you know, the odd person that you'd heard about who was either, you know, who'd had problems or was schizophrenic or was struggling with something, but that was that, you know, and it was like, have you heard about Mandy? She's gone a bit woohoo, you know. That was all we did, you know. There wasn't really any visible support there. Just wasn't talked about.
Yeah, it's crazy. And yet on the podcast, time and time again, we talked to the guests and university was the worst time they'd experienced.
Yeah.
You know, what I think that's happening?
The pressure. Well, I think because there was so much pressure, because everybody kept saying to me when I was a kid, oh, university is the best time of your life, it's the best time of your life. And then you go there and you go, this is awful. I was in the wrong university. I went to York University, which, you know, I chose it. I'll be very honest. It had a really pretty picture on the prospectus and I didn't really know where I wanted to go. And I thought, that looks nice. And it was a weird mix of people. It was kind of a bit, it was a bit of an Oxbridge reject university. There was quite a lot of... I mean, I did make lovely friends that I've still got today, lovely, lovely friends. But it was a very, please forgive me, York University, but the campus is an absolute eyesore. It's like an NCP car park from the 60s. It has awful mists that come in and just sit there for days. So visually, it is really depressing. It's got these lakes with geese in it, so it's covered in goose shit. Big bands didn't go there or anything. I had to go to Leeds or Manchester to go there, to go see somebody else, you know. And, yeah, there wasn't an awful lot going on. So it was fine. I got through it. Still sort of struggling with my sexuality. I've told a few friends and that sort of thing, but, you know, just felt a bit lost. Just felt really, you know, lost and not... I joined the... I think it was a gay and lesbian society. All I remember was there was one man with a cravat. And then some very, very militant lesbians and they were really into just sort of, oh, God, the stuff they used to occupy themselves with. They wanted to change certain words. It was herstory, not history. It was a person hole, not a man hole. And I remember going to these meetings going, is this really? I felt a complete misfit within the group I was supposed to be part of, you know.
So you were at a very different point in your journey figuring out your sexuality.
Yeah.
So you're still out here saying, I think I'm that thing that people get beaten up for.
And they're talking
about manhole covers.
I know, yes, exactly. And herstory. And how dare a man open a door for you? I'm like, I really don't mind if a man opens a door for me. I find it quite fine, you know. So it took me ages to find a space.
And that's the weird thing, like you said, that there's this thing put on young people that it's going to be the best time of your life, and yet you're also going to be figuring out who you are. And I tend to find those two things don't come as a pair.
No, really. And it's, you know, I had no clue what I wanted to do with my life at all. It wasn't, you know, I didn't know what leaving university was the next big plummet in, you know, in my sanity. When I left there, I went, I have genuinely no idea what I want to do. Really didn't. It was horrible. I remember leaving uni and that first time. So you've gone from school to uni and then everything's gone and I had no real idea of where to go and what to do. It took a long time to sort of figure that out. Yeah. Still figuring it out.
Do you mind sharing a few of the false starts of things you tried that didn't end up being your thing?
Well, I thought I wanted to be a photographer for a while. I did quite a lot of...
Is it weird to say I think you've got a good haircut for that?
Thank you. No, but I quite like that, yeah. How do you relate my hair to being a photographer?
I think I'm just maybe the photographers I've met. I'm like, they kind of have quite cool haircuts.
That's great. I'll take that.
Maybe it's practical. Absolutely. Maybe it's if you practical. Had like long...
locks down to your ass, they're going to get into the lens or something.
Get across the lens. I've got a photographer's haircut. I like that. I'm going to take that. Yeah, I did a lot of photography at university, which meant I did like the photography for the student newspapers. And it just meant I spent a very long time in dark rooms on my own with chemicals, which I did as well in the 90s. So it's... But I never really pursued that. I thought about going on to sort of art school or something after uni to maybe do that, but then I didn't really pursue that. I spent a long time at university doing plays and stuff and mucking about with the drama department. So that was the kernel of thought. Right. That was the sort of, I wonder if I could do something with that. But always lacked confidence, Like I was too nervous to apply for drama school initially or any of those things. Yeah, I just really lacked the confidence. So I waitressed for a long time, and I did a lot of bar work and the usual sort of crappy jobs that people do when they don't really know what they're doing with themselves. And then I did apply for drama school, and I got into drama school in London. I went to London and went to drama school for 2 years, which I enjoyed,
And so it sounds like you'd found this thing. You were still figuring out, okay, what kind of performance, but you knew that was the
that, genre. Yeah, because you... There's no rhyme nor reason to this career. I use the word career very loosely. But I think back to the time when I was 20, leaving university, and all of the worries I had about what I was going to do and how it was going to pan out and where I was going to find my feet in the world, I couldn't have planned any of the things that have happened to me. And it's been fine. It's all been all right, you know. It has. It's all been all right. And it's interesting to see, you know, to look back and kind of go, all of those things you worry about, most of them just don't come to fruition anyway.
And that's not something you're told.
No.
And equally, you're not told that most people don't have a fucking clue when they leave university.
When you realise that most people are absolutely winging it, then you're just so much more... Life is so much easier, you know. There's a thing about being a performer and that we all suffer from imposter syndrome, and it's absolutely true. It's totally true. And, you know, even incredibly successful, incredibly famous people who've done an incredible amount of work will worry when a period of work finishes and they go, well, that's it, I'm over, I'm done, I'm complete. That's, you know, that we all worry about that. Or that somebody will knock on the door and go, you've been found out, and actually, you know, it has transpired that you have absolutely no talent whatsoever and you've just managed to string us along for this period of time. We all worry about those things. That's why I think honesty is so important when it comes to mental health, because once we realise that we all have something going on in our minds and our mental state, and we're all vulnerable, and we all have moments of when we can't do something, and it's fine. And as long as we open up and say that to each other, it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's normalising it.
Yeah.
And the more I host a podcast like this, the more I'm like, you know what? It's such a normal response to so many of the things I hear. I'm like, if you didn't have depression at the end of that, I'd be more worried about you. And particularly where we're at the moment in the world, this weird thing that you mentioned in the show where politically things seem to make less sense than ever, and yet everyone has more opinions than ever.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, objectively, if you look back in history, we're doing pretty good compared to most of human history, and yet it feels the worst it's ever been.
Mm.
If that's not anxiety inducing, I don't know what is.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I think I think we are being largely manipulated these days. But I think we're far easier to govern and to manage if we're slightly tense and anxious. I do think we're deliberately being made to feel more anxious than we actually ought to be. You know, like you say, we have running water. Most, you know, the majority of people in the country, not all obviously, have a roof over their heads. Of course, it's a terrible situation. But generally, in this country, you've got a loo and you've got running water and you've got access to food and medical care and all of those things. And like I say in the show, none of us are being burnt for being a witch. We're lucky in this country. And I think we forget that. That we're beginning to forget because the political situation is so weird and so strange. We're looking at what we don't have and not what we do have, and I feel like we're being manipulated.
I kind of get what you mean, particularly when you said about being made to worry more than feels necessary.
Yeah,
because that is how a lot of politics functions. That you've got to demonize the other side of every argument at the moment. Yeah. Everything's got to be like, you either vote for me or death.
Yeah.
It's got that extreme and divided.
And most of the things people are talking about actually don't affect an average person on a day-to-day basis. For example, you know, when my mother says there's too many immigrants in the country, I'm like, you live in Hove. When did you last even trip over an immigrant? I mean, when has this ever affected you in your day-to-day, you know, because we're being told stuff is affecting us or being told we should be worried about this, but actually not in your day-to-day, walking down the pavement in our little lives, how much of it actually is affecting us?
And I certainly noticed that myself, coming from an Irish immigrant background, that so often people's opinions on immigrants and the prevalence of them is informed by mostly people who serve them. For so many people, they're interacting with people from an immigrant background who are more commonly in like service industry than people that are white British, for example. And then I just wonder, how have you got a negative opinion? These people spend their lives helping you out. There are doctors, there are nurses, they're doing the bins because it's actually a well-paid job and nobody white British wants to do it. Whilst all that's going on, we've also got all this international news that historically there wasn't as much of. So everyone's getting stressed about what's happening in a country they've never been to and probably never will.
Yeah, we're bombarded with information that actually we can't deal with it all. We can't deal with it all. I know a lot of people worry horribly about climate change and you know, impact on the planet. And to the extent where it's so much information that you just feel like you can't do anything, you can't deal with it all.
Well, you can get kind of frozen into doing nothing.
Yeah.
Because there's just so many things we're all meant to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you're a good human, but only if you do these 50 things.
Yeah.
Donate to all these charities and it's not possible.
It's just not possible. It's absolutely not possible. So I think we just need to learn to filter it out a little.
Yeah.
Protect thyself.
You have to. And I think particularly to link it back a little bit to mental illness, so many of the conditions come with symptoms around questioning yourself, self-doubt, wondering if you're worthy of certain things. And so it's hard for people to, when they're experiencing mental illness, to prioritise their mental health because it can feel selfish. But actually it's in everyone's best interest. In the same way, sometimes filtering some of this stuff out, you have to just do for your survival.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
Because historically humans have done it.
And the only thing you can do if you want to make an impact on the planet and other people is be kind. It's as simple as that. It's really simple. Be kind and be empathetic and try and interact with your fellow human beings.
Yeah, kindness is vastly underrated.
It's a huge thing. And tiny, tiny, tiny little acts of kindness can produce so much joy.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And we have gone off on a wonderful little tangent, which I very much appreciate. To link back to, I think, roughly where we were, you were talking about first kind of realising that performance was for you.
Yes.
And you're still figuring it out.
Yeah.
So what was happening with your mental health around that time, like being in drama school and starting your performance career?
God, when I was about 26, I was still just finishing drama school and I had first proper breakup of, actually the only proper breakup I've ever had. And, it was a pretty tough year. It was a really tough, miserable year. Moving out of the flat that we'd shared, losing friends, had to move to a part of London that I hated, sharing with some really bad. The worst part was it's loneliness. That was the big thing, loneliness. I had friends at drama school, but I was working during the days. Drama school I went to, you studied at night and at weekends so that you could work during the days to pay for it. And it was a really brutally miserable time in my life. Being desperately unhappy because I'd split up with somebody, being lonely because I'd lost a lot of friends.
And that makes such a difference, mental health-wise, because you're left with your own thoughts more if you're lonelier.
I spend a lot of time on my own, now even later in life, and I've learned to deal with it. But we are such social beasts, and if we don't talk, it just it's just an endless loop in our heads. When I think back, I was utterly miserable at that time, like really properly miserable and really lonely. That was, yeah, horrible.
Because people are such a normalizing force, because you can be around all the constant terror happening through the media, all the horrible things happening on the news cycles, and then you go for a coffee with a friend and you talk about nothing for an hour.
And it's lovely, isn't it? Small talk.
And it was really great for kind of bringing you back down to your part of the earth.
So I have learned through life and through that period that loneliness is really hard and really tricky to deal with. And I really, really value the company of other people now. Really do. Yeah, really, really do. As a comedian, you spend so much time on your own. It's the worst profession in the world. It really is for that, you know. I'm living on my own up here in Edinburgh. I found myself chatting to myself today. Would you like an egg? I'd love an egg. Thanks for asking. And I'm better at dealing with it. But yes, that time in my life, 26, 27, living in Peckham in a really weird house share with somebody who was essentially a member of a cult. It was a really odd time. Being heartbroken and being lonely.
Yeah. And also being lonely around other people.
People always assume you're the life and soul of a party if you're a comedian. I'm really not. I like my company bespoke, if you know what I mean. I'm really not the life and soul. I will sink into a corner. But I do cherish the company of my friends very, very much. Very much now, yeah. Mm. Treat myself to their company, if you know what I mean. You know, even if somebody hasn't phoned for ages or whatever, just make an effort to speak to somebody, because it makes me feel so much happier just being in the company of people.
It makes such a difference.
Oh, huge, yeah.
No, and I know if I was having a tough day today, I don't know who the friends are that I'd call, because there's some that just cheer me up in their very existence.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's a formula we all have to work out. One thing I'm still trying to figure out is that I'm very extroverted, and yet, you know, I have several different jobs I'm balancing, and so I spend a lot of the time exhausted.
Yeah.
And so that's a really weird balance where I want to be around people all the time.
Yeah.
But I can't cope with being around people all the time. And there's not an easy way to, like, socialise where you can be in the same room as someone and not talk to them. And often that's exactly what I need.
Yeah.
It's like you may speak, but only if I start the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't see who's going to agree with that.
No. You need to, I don't know, go to the cinema or something and sit beside them. That's
As a side note, I do have a funny story about one time I went to the cinema on my own. Because I'm a strong, independent adult and I can do things on my own, so I thought I'd go to the cinema. And I went to see The Danish Girl. And so that particular day, I was like wearing a lot of jewellery, and I was wearing a jumper that really was long enough to be a dress, with still trousers under it, you know, modest. But I came out of it at the end and I was on my own, and I'd found it really emotional to watch. I'm not trans myself, but it just really moved me.
Yeah.
And I've known enough people that have gone through similar experiences. And I got so many sympathetic looks, because they just saw this guy that looked kind of a bit gender ambiguous and was like notably saddened by watching a film. And everyone was being very nice to me. And I felt like I was completely misappropriating someone else's culture.
Oh, lovely though. It's funny what you say, sort of being a strong, independent person going to the cinema on your own. I think it can
take a while. I mean, going to a restaurant for the first time on my own, I remember that when I was younger.
Mm.
That was a big deal.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've got so used to doing it now. I like to walk into restaurants now, because I'm often eating on my own. And it's just when they ask how many, and I go, party of one. It makes me feel happier.
I love that.
Yeah.
I've now got this visual of you having a party on your one.
It's that weird thing of balance between acknowledging and accepting loneliness, but also being comfortable in your own company and not and doing things for yourself as well. I've got a lot better at doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like it's something you've maybe got better at coping with, but are you less lonely, do you feel?
Am I less lonely? I think I probably am less lonely now, because I've realised how lonely I was doing this job and spending so much time on my own. I'll tell you what happened. I did a tour last year, at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, 50 dates on my own. I don't have a support act because the finances don't support it. It doesn't make any sense. I don't have a tour manager because the finances don't support that either. So I spent a lot of time travelling on my own, being in weird hotel rooms on my own and being people's entertainment, which is really odd when you feel so lonely. Mm-hmm. It's so odd to turn up and be somebody's reason for having booked a childminder when you feel really low, like, you know, it's a weird thing. It's such a juxtaposition of things.
Most of your audience are out with friends and family as well.
They're all out with friends and family. You have travelled there on your own. You're staying in a weird little B&B on your own. And sometimes the first conversation you've had of the day is with the tech guy, you know, who couldn't be less interested. So I got, at the end of that tour, which finished in February this year, I realised I was properly depressed, really down, because I'd spent so much time on my own. And so, you know, introspectively thinking about things. And of course, you can't help but compare yourself to other people. It's such a destructive thing to do, you know. So I'd be crying in a travel lodge in Cumbria and then turning on Facebook and, you know, one of my peers was doing a sold-out show in the West End Theatre in London. And you just, it's hard on the old ego sometimes. And I got really down and quite fat. That happened as well. Just sort of eat a lot. My lowest moment, I think, came when I was in Whitehaven in Cumbria. There was an ice storm. That didn't help. It was actually raining ice. The number of people I had in for the show was really low because it was the final of Strictly Come Dancing and the woman said, oh, they don't come out when Strictly's on. I was like, I've been on a train for 5 hours to get here. And that night I sat in bed with a bobble hat on, eating an entire rotisserie chicken. Utterly miserable. You know, you sort of look at yourself and go, this hasn't panned out well, has it? So I got very depressed and quite chunky and I decided March this year I was just going to make a change. Just when I felt lonely, just phone a friend, arrange to hook up with people. My phone never rings. I don't know whether I'm unusual, but nobody ever calls me. I don't know whether I'm unusual in this, but like, I never get any calls from people.
I don't think that is unusual. I get loads of sales calls.
Do you? Do people call each other anymore? Is that just a thing? Is it gone?
I call people, but I think I'm very unusual in my generation in that.
Yeah.
Because people don't call me back.
No,
and like people will reply to text if I've called them, which I find a very odd thing. Yes, because I clearly wanted to speak to you.
Why are you writing back at me? Yeah.
And so then I end up calling them when they are free.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? It's nice to find out that I'm not the only one. Because I think nobody ever called. I've got maybe three friends that maybe call me sort of every now and again. But other than that, no. So I made a real effort to sort of reach out, organise things, get together with people and have some happy times, fun times, communal times with people.
It is funny that though you have to start scheduling it.
Yeah, scheduling some fun times.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done since March. And it's really helped me an awful lot. My mental health is I'm in a really good place right now. Really, really good place right now. I also started the thing I found later in life that is helping me tremendously with my mental state is exercise. I used to a few years ago. I used to run quite a lot, and then I stopped. And with stopping, I you know the misery started to creep back in. And it was my wife that went, for the love of God, put your running shoes on and go running. You are much happier when you run. So I did, and I joined a gym. And I got a personal trainer who's become a really good friend and it's become a thing. And I'm so much happier. I'm so much happier. It's such a basic, simple thing. And I know we hear it, people say it's cliche, isn't it? You know, get exercise for a happier mind. But honestly, it has helped me so much, so much.
I think that's part of why people are cynical of it, because it almost sounds too simple.
It's too simple. You're like, how can this be true? It's just great. It's really saved me. And I love being outside. I love being outside. I really like being outside and sniffing the breeze. Happiness for me is in tiny little things now. Tiny, tiny little things. A breeze. I can really enjoy a breeze. And I remember my dad talking to me like this when I was younger about, you know, the little thing. And I'm thinking, surely it's not that. That surely isn't happiness. Surely it's, you know, other things. Surely it's far more glamorous and involving than that, far more entertaining than that. It's not. It's really not. It's really little things. Really little things.
Yeah, it stops raining when you walk outside.
Yeah. Your toast even the rain, even burnt. The sound of rain is not. Or, you know, when it rains and you can smell it? And you can smell the herbs in the air? And the if it's that, that's pure joy. That's total joy for me. Yeah.
And that's it, I think, in a general sense, that's kind of what a lot of, like, mindfulness and meditation is about. It's actually just slowing us down because we live in this world where it's so much about the next thing. And when you're in a career like comedy, well, your whole career is then about the next thing.
That's a very valid and important point. And that's something I've learned maybe in the last 2 years, that actually the time is now. It's nothing to do about the next thing, because the next thing is an imagined thing and it doesn't actually exist. It only exists in our minds, whereas the only thing that is relevant is now. Yeah. And the past, gone. The future doesn't exist. And it's learning to live within the moment and enjoy the moment. And I know and I'm aware of so many comics who aren't enjoying the ride. And I was one of those people, you know. You got to enjoy the ride. Look out the window. It's part of what's going on, you know. Because what is the destination? I tell you what it is. Death. That's what it is. That's the end game. That is. Yeah, we're so obsessed with achieving and moving forward that we forget to just be.
Mm.
And it's so important. I'm 47. It's taken me a long time to get to this point in my life. But I can honestly say I'm probably the happiest I've ever been.
Yeah. It's that change in perspective because otherwise your happiness is always dependent on the future career progress that you'll never catch up with.
No. And the other thing is I've learned is, you know, it's not putting all your mental eggs in one basket either. I love what I do. I'm really grateful for the work I get, but it's not my entirety. I'm not just a comedian, not all the things. I'm an auntie, you know, a partner. I'm a friend. I like sniffing the breeze.
You're a breeze sniffer.
I'm a breeze sniffer. That sounds really... Ooh, what's she? Breeze sniffer. Oh, dear.
Sauvignon breeze.
Yeah. That's a relief as well, to sort of get to that point in life when you realise this isn't all of me, you know?
Yeah, and that's so important. And I love what you said about being happy on the journey.
Yeah.
That you don't have to wait for certain milestones
to enjoy it. For permission to be happy either. I think a lot of us are just waiting for permission to be happy. Like that day, like when I get this, it'll be that. When I get this, it'll be that. When I get this, it'll be that. Once I've done that, I'll do that. Once I've done that. And it's like, no. It's no. It's now or never. And I think with advancing years, that becomes more obvious. You know, I think with the time pressure of life, you know, you kind of go, you know, I'm middle-aged and you go, Jesus, if I don't start enjoying myself now, what the hell am I waiting for? So, I'm just a lot more positive. Yeah.
It's really great. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot more recently, looking at my work and what I do and getting to be self-employed and thinking about the little me all those years ago, that this was the dream.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm still so future-focused, and so I'm the same, trying to really...
Really
appreciate what I have.
Yeah. I mean, we live in a world where it is so easy for us to compare ourselves to everybody else.
Yeah, easier than ever.
We are so aware. And here we're, you know, recording this in Edinburgh at the festival, where it is basically just a lot of people comparing themselves to everybody else. That's what it is. And, you know, therein madness lies. Because it doesn't matter what you do or what you achieve, somebody will always do it better. Somebody will, you know, you climb Everest in record time, somebody will pogo up it the next week. It's fine, be happy with your achievements. Your achievements, your successes and failures are in absolutely no way related to anybody else's successes and failures. They're independently unique to you.
Absolutely. And the irony is the things that are less aspirational are often the things that make you happier. So like you mentioned, being a good friend, well, we all want to be a good friend, but you have the friends that you have, and no one else has the same friends.
Yeah.
So you can be a pro at being friends to those people
yeah.
a lot easier than you can be the number one comic in even your patch of ground,
let
alone a city or a country.
It is. It's little things that make you... We have such a global view now that it's hard. Bring it back in, just look closer to home, I think.
I don't think humans are built for it, honestly.
No, we
formed in tribes when we were out, wild humans once upon a day. We'd form small groups. That's what was the natural thing.
Yeah.
And yet now we're fully informed on the plights of people we don't even know.
In a
way that we may not know what's happening to one of our closest friends if we haven't spoken to them recently.
Yeah.
And that's a very weird place to be living in.
Yeah, exactly.
And on say that reflective note, I think we'll wrap up the interview. If people want to learn more about you, where should they find you online?
I am on Twitter. I'm not very good at it.
I disagree. and I will read a tweet of yours if you don't believe me.
On Twitter at Zoe Lyons. I've just joined Instagram and honestly, I'm like your nan. I haven't a clue what I'm doing. I keep losing followers because I think I keep reposting things because I don't know how to work it. And that's Zoe Lyons Comedy. And then my website, which I very rarely update, is just zoelyons.co.uk. And I will put up some gigs on there at some point.
We don't know when.
I don't know
eventually.
When. Yeah.
Between now
I'm
and then.
I'm pressure myself.
Grand. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Been a total pleasure. Nice chatting to you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.